Well, hey, how's everybody? Oh, there you all are. Wow, I didn't see you when we first started. It's great. Man, thank you. That was just a little dig on all of you guys who came in late, but that's okay. We're glad that you are here. Welcome. Whether you're here in person or whether you're joining us online, thank you guys for being here to worship God and really celebrate the Advent season with us. You know, Advent means coming to the world. It's God's advent into the world on our behalf, so we're really excited for this season. Hey, I want to start by reminding you of a few things, just so that you're in the loop. I want to get you out in front of this for the rest of the year. Next week, we're going to be having church at our normal time, and we're going to have baptisms, so you're going to really want to make sure that you, if you can't be here, make sure you watch online later, because that's really exciting for us. We're a new church, right? We've only been in existence for about 9 months now. It's awesome that God is using our church to wake people up to the gospel, to save them, to turn them around, to help them live on mission. So that's really cool. So you'll want to make sure that you're here for that or you're watching for that. But then we're hosting our first Christmas Eve service on the 23rd at 6 p.m. So make sure you're inviting people to that. We're going to have Christmas carols, hot chocolate. It's for the whole family. So I hope that you'll bring your kids and you'll come to that. There won't be any child care, but we'll just all be in here together, and it's going to be really fun. So make sure you invite people. There's going to be a short gospel presentation, especially if you've been investing in somebody who's not a Christian and you want them to hear the gospel. Bring them to that. It's a great time. That's why we're doing it. That's why we're doing it. So I hope you'll take advantage of it. But then also Sunday, December 26th, we're not going to be meeting. Okay, we're going to take that day off, that Sunday off after Christmas. So I hope that you enjoy that time with your family. The reason we really do that is to give our leaders and our serve teams a break at the end of the year. It's just a rhythm that we're going to begin. So I hope you guys will enjoy that day. Spend it with your family. Spend it with people that you've been pouring into with the gospel and you've been living missionally with. Do that and enjoy that day. And then we're going to start back up on January 2nd. Will be our first Sunday back for the year. I'm going to have a special sermon from one of the Psalms on that day, and then we're going to get started in a vision series. We're going to call Vision 2022 the following Sunday on the 9th. You won't want to miss that because we're going to talk about who we are as a church and how that's going to impact our year next year. So that's where we're going. I want you guys to know that so that you know where we're at and where we're going over the next month or two. But today, we're going to be in our Reimagining Christmas series again, looking at Matthew chapter 2. So if you want to find that on your device, turn there in your Bible. You're welcome to do that with us. It'll also be on the screens if you need it. But we're going backwards here in this series, right? It's because we're reimagining Christmas. I'm trying to be creative with it, okay? So we were in chapter 3 last week. We're in chapter 2 this week. We're talking about how Christmas is one of the most strategic times of the year to live on mission. Christmas is not about us and our families. That's not what it's about, despite what the Hallmark Channel will tell you. It's about God building his family in the world. That's what Christmas is about. And of course, that's very radical in our American individualistic culture to think like that. It usually elicits one of two responses, either acceptance and belief or rejection and anger. People get frustrated by that. And in our text today, we're going to see how that plays out in stark contrast between Herod on the one hand and then the wise men or the Magi on the other hand. We're going to see how Matthew's comparing the two of them, Herod and the Magi. They both have this dramatic response to the claims made about the Messiah here. One to worship, the other to reject. And of course, we'll see that worshiping Jesus is the only wise response coming out of this, hence the reason why we might call them wise men, because they're the ones who worship, while the choice to reject Jesus always leads to tragedy and frustration and death. And so if you're taking notes today, our main point is that true wisdom is to worship Jesus as King. That's true wisdom. We're going to also see that that's true worship. So maybe you're here today and you're listening to this or you're listening online and you're not a Christian. And me saying that automatically starts to rub you the wrong way a little bit, you know? You think it's extremely arrogant to think that Jesus is the only way, especially when so many questions come up about who he is, about how he fulfills all these. I mean, if we just look at this text alone today that we're looking at, we have to deal with some major things. We have to deal with the claim that Jesus was God. We have to deal with the claim that a good God would allow tragedy and evil to occur, and that's somehow not contradictory to his nature. We have to deal with the fact that there are supernatural events that did and still do occur according to the Bible and the writers of the Bible. I mean, there's a lot of stuff here, and I get that. These are all good questions. They all demand answers if Christianity claims to be true, which it does. And I've had some of these questions. I still do have some questions about some of these things of my own as a pastor, as a Christian, you know? But my challenge to you, if you're not a Christian here today and you're listening to this, man, wrestle with these things. Wrestle with these claims that Matthew makes about Jesus in our text today. Especially if you trust somebody that you know who is a Christian. Man, dig in with them. They believe these things for a reason. Ask them why. Go to them and talk to them about why they believe what they believe. Because I'm only going to be able to cover so much in our time today, right? Like, you might leave here with more questions than you had coming in. And so if you do, I want you to go hash it out with somebody that you know, that you trust, who's a Jesus follower, who's a Christian. Because this is one of those claims that's just too big to avoid, all right? The Bible, and by extension, Christians all across the world today, all throughout history, millions upon millions, probably billions upon billions of people believe this. And it's a claim that's just too big to ignore. And it'd be one thing if they were outrageous claims that just didn't make any sense, and I won't name any other religions or cults that are like that. But the thing about Christianity is it's a worldview based in truth. Like, we're claiming that these things are true, that they actually happen. There's historical and textual evidence behind these things that we believe, along with philosophical reasoning. It's very important for us. And it appears that Jesus' claims are pretty well substantiated, actually. And Matthew's claims, even here in Matthew chapter 2, are pretty well substantiated. And so we have to deal with that. And it's going to elicit either one of two reactions. You're going to either reject it, like Herod, or you're going to respond and worship, like the wise men. I heard Pastor Andrew Hopper use this example at Mercy Hill one year, a couple of years ago. I thought it was very helpful for us. Maybe you actually remember this event. It was back in 2018. Hawaii actually had a ballistic missile scare. I don't know if you remember. Did anybody remember this happening on the news? Yeah, a few of you. Yeah, it's crazy. All of Hawaii woke up one January morning to find an alert on their phones, all over the radio, all over the news, that said an imminent strike was coming their way. It was happening, and the alert that they got ended by stating, "This is not a drill." Okay, so it was the alarm. The alarm was going off, and so for 38 minutes of their morning, there was either one of two reactions going on, all right? Either people were freaking out, and they were saying their last prayers, and they were diving for their bunkers if they had any. They're trying to get into safe places. Or they just went about their normal day and didn't believe it. You know, either you're thinking, this is it, or you look at it and go, somebody's losing their job today. That's got to be a mistake. You know? And that's what ended up happening. Okay, that's what happened. It was a false alarm. Somebody had accidentally activated the alert system. So somebody did lose their job. I read about who that was and how the article was. It was very sad for them. I mean, they did lose it. They probably deserved it, you know. So they lost their job. But the point is that for 38 minutes, there were only two responses in this scenario. There couldn't be any other than two. There were only two. Either you believed it and you were spending time with those that you loved during those 38 minutes thinking that this was it because you can't get off the islands. Or you ignored it and you just went about your normal day. You didn't believe it. And so everything was as is. You thought it was fake. But the only thing that you couldn't do in that moment was treat it like some kind of lukewarm response. You couldn't take a middle stance there. There wasn't like, well, I don't know, you know. It's like, no, either it's that's fake, or, man, we have got to do something to spend our last moments on earth together. Like, it's that kind of weighty type of situation, right? And so today Matthew pushes us to that kind of response with Jesus here. That's what it's like for Christians. Either Jesus is the king of the universe, sent from God, and he deserves our worship, or he's not, and he deserves to be rejected. But what isn't possible is to take some kind of middle stance there. You're either taking one or the other. That's just the reality of it, because the claims are so big. And this is what C.S. Lewis said of this: Christianity, if false, is of no importance, and if true, is of infinite importance. The one thing that it cannot be is moderately important. There's just no possible way. I mean, you might think it's moderately important, but that's apathy. And apathy is also a response. You see the point that I'm making? There's just no middle ground. So that's what Matthew 2 points us to. Let's jump into the text to see how that plays out for us here in this story. Let's start in verse 1, Matthew chapter 2, verse 1. This is what it says. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was deeply disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. And he probably was very disturbed here because he hadn't had a baby, right? So, well, this wasn't his child that was born to be king. Remember, this is what they say here is who was born king, not born to be king, but born king. So I'm sure he was alarmed. They were talking about the long-foretold Messiah to come is what he deduced here. At least that's how he took it, because in the next thing he says, he assembled all the chief priests and scribes of the people and asked them where the Messiah would be born. So he's putting two and two together here. In Bethlehem of Judea, they told him, because this is what was written by the prophet. And they quote Micah chapter 5, verse 2, "And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, because out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." So we're thrust right into the middle of the story here. And before we go any further, let me just talk a little bit about this. It's jam-packed with a lot of information. I want to look at Jesus, the wise men, and Herod very briefly, and then we'll move on. Start with Jesus here, okay? Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea. So that's the city of David. It's right outside of Jerusalem. It's the place where King David himself was born and raised, was called into ministry, you know, by the prophet. And the Gospel of Luke gives us the details here. Jesus was born because Mary and Joseph, though they were from Nazareth, had to travel to Bethlehem because that's where they were from. Their ancestors were from Bethlehem, so they were of the lineage of David. And when the Romans did a census, they needed to go back to their homeland. And so they go down to Bethlehem from Nazareth. Jesus is born there because they go while Mary is with child or she's pregnant. So Matthew 4 goes, the Luke story details. He doesn't talk about the shepherds or the angels or the manger and all of that, that's there. He just probably emphasizes the royal nature of Jesus' birth, because Matthew is claiming that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. That's what he's doing here in this chapter. He's referencing the Old Testament so we understand how Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. In chapter 1, which we'll study next week when we look at the birth story proper of Jesus, he's already pegged Jesus as a descendant of King David, who's arguably the most honored king in Jewish history, right? And we see him quote several Old Testament prophets in this chapter alone to prove that Jesus fulfills all of these Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah. The one we just read from Micah is a prophecy that the Messiah would be born in a specific place in Bethlehem of the lineage of David. So he's saying that Jesus is the rightful heir to David's throne. He's born in David's hometown. He's the apparent king of Judah to come that the prophets have foretold about. At least that's how the wise men took it, because notice they didn't ask where the prince would be born, the one who would become king. They asked, okay, where's the king born? There were rumors even of this great king who would come out of Judah. There were rumors all over the Middle East at the time, in the ancient days. And so the wise men believe that, and they're asking these questions. So we're introduced to the wise men as well here. Some translations call them magi, which it probably means what you might think it would mean. They're magicians, astrologers, people who were in the priestly caste, revered as powerful and great men, a lot like our scientists and academics might be revered today, at least depending on who you talk to and where you come from. Maybe they're revered, maybe they're not. But I hate to be the actually guy here. Actually, we're never told how many of them showed up to worship Jesus. You recognize that, right? Like, we're reading the Bible. If we're actually reading the Bible here, it never tells us that there are three. Three is probably based on the amount of gifts that were given to them, but you know, I can give my wife three gifts and there's not three of me, right? So it doesn't mean anything about how many there were. So who knows how many there actually were here. Sorry to ruin your childhood if that radically changes the way that you view the Christmas songs or the nativity scene that you have in your house right now. But what's important is that we understand these guys were spiritualists. They were pagans. You could describe the wise men as seekers, really. They were seekers, and I think that's important for us in the story here that Matthew is trying to point out. They were seeking the truth of the claims that were made in Jewish scripture. These are non-Jews looking at the scriptures, hearing the rumors, and they're seeking out the truth to see if this is true or not. And they were most likely from Persia, maybe even Babylon. So it's highly likely that there were very much still Jewish influences that were there, right? Because if you remember the Old Testament stories, you'll remember guys like Daniel, you know, who had a major influence in the Persian and Babylonian empires, prominent place in the emperor's palace. Mordecai and Esther, that story, they had a prominent place in Persian culture. Later, Ezra and Nehemiah. I mean, there's a bunch of Jews back in this time from this part, from the exile, which is very interesting and a whole other sermon in itself, that there was so much influence from them where they were that now there's rumors about this great king who would come out of Judah and people are believing it. And there's probably the scriptures from the Old Testament, at least some of the scriptures. You can imagine that the Magi at least had some of the Old Testament writings as a result of that, because the star imagery comes directly from something that Moses wrote in Numbers. Now, I don't know if you remember this story. If you grew up in church at all, we're digging into the Old Testament stories a lot here, because that's where Jesus comes from. That's where the proof texts come from for Jesus as Messiah. And there's one in Numbers about a guy named Balaam. Maybe you remember him most notably for his donkey that talks to him. I don't know. It's a very, very weird story. If you go back and read this in Numbers chapters 20, 22, 23, and 24. But to make a long story short, basically Balaam prophesies about the Messiah. And he does this in chapter 24. He says, I see him, but not here and now. I perceive him, but far in the distant future. A star will rise from Jacob. A scepter will emerge from Israel. That's Numbers 24, verse 17. So that's probably what this is in reference to. This star that the wise men followed is probably a result of this prophecy. However that looks, however it ends up connecting in their astronomical studies, however you say that, these guys were stargazers. They were looking, they were seeking, they were trying to figure out whether the claims of Jewish scriptures like this one could be taken seriously, and they decided to test them out. As they did their stargazing, as they did their investigating, it's really cool that they were taken straight to this newborn king in Bethlehem at this particular time in human history. Very cool stuff. But then there was Herod. Okay, so let's move on. We could talk more about them. But Herod and the religious leaders that were there as well in Jerusalem, they weren't convinced of all these things. They didn't want to worship. They weren't testing the claims. As a matter of fact, they were alarmed by them, right? They didn't want to believe it. Herod was the king appointed by Rome over Judea at this time. He was really not Jewish. He was, I think, was an Edomite. Maybe one of his ancestors was Jewish or something like that. But he represented the Jews. He was the king of the Jews. That was his title. And he had the ear of all the religious leaders of the Jewish people at this time. And see, when they all heard these claims, they were alarmed. They didn't want to believe it. And this is just my take on it. But they were probably alarmed about the Messiah because if it was true, it would upset their status quo. Like, they didn't want to be made uncomfortable at this time. I mean, again, that's my take on it. But, I mean, that's what the Messiah was there to do. That's why the Messiah would come. He was supposed to challenge the oppressors of the day and shake things up, right? So the Messiah will upset our status quo. If you're taking notes, I think that's worth writing down. That's what the Messiah should do. That's why he would come. But see, they had peace, and they didn't want that to be upset. They were somewhat left alone to be in charge of the people in Judea. They didn't want to change that. They didn't want to change their influence and their power. They felt threatened by the Messiah. They didn't want him to come and upset their comfortable lives. And the contrast is further made in the next part of the story. So let's read the rest of this. I'm going to read all of chapter 2. I just think it's a good story. We probably know it, or at least parts of it, if we have heard the Christmas story at all. But very interesting. And then we'll get into our points for today after I read all of this. So stick with it here. Then Herod secretly summoned the wise men and asked them the exact time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, report back to me so that I too can go and worship him. False, but that's what he says to him. After hearing the king, they went on their way, and there it was, the star they had seen at its rising. And it led them until it came and stopped above the place where the child was. Now, we don't know what that means. I'm not even going to try to figure out. There was astrological signs, perhaps. I think it was probably supernatural. That's probably what was going on here. Whatever it was, when they saw the star, they were overwhelmed with joy. Their response is the key thing here. Whatever that looked like, whatever the star was, they were overwhelmed with joy when they saw that star. Entering the house, and there's another killjoy for you, song crusher for you. He wasn't in a stable, right? They weren't in a stable here. They were in a house when the wise men got to them. They weren't at the nativity scene, okay, whatever that looked like. They were in a house, and they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and falling to their knees, they worshipped him. And then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Those are all kingly gifts, right? Being warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their own country by another route. And after that, after they were gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and stay there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to kill him. So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and escaped to Egypt. And he stayed there until Herod's death, so that what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, that's from Hosea chapter 11, actually, might be fulfilled. Out of Egypt I called my son. And then Herod, when he realized that he had been outwitted by the wise men, he flew into a rage. He was prone to do this. This is how he killed a lot of people in his time. So this is not out of the ordinary for somebody like Herod. But he gave orders to massacre all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and under. Can you imagine? In keeping with the time he had learned from the wise men. And then what was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. A voice was heard in Ramah weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and she refused to
be consoled because they are no more. And after Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt again, saying, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, because those who intended to kill the child are dead." So he got up, he took the child and his mother, and entered the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And being warned in a dream, again, there's a lot of dreams going on here with Joseph, he withdrew to the region of Galilee. And then he went and settled in a town called Nazareth to fulfill what was spoken through the prophets, that he, speaking of Jesus, would be called a Nazarene. Okay, I know there's a lot. We won't talk about all of that. It's just good to get that in context so we understand the story. Let's start with our first point for today, which is going to look like it comes out of left field, but I'll explain it here in just a second, all right? The first point is the gospel is for everyone. That's what Matthew is trying to teach us here. The gospel is for everyone. The Magi were Gentiles. They were not Jewish. They weren't part of God's chosen people, you know? As a matter of fact, when you read the Old Testament and guys like this came up and they were referred to as the Magi from the Persian courts and whatever they were pagans. They were occultists. They were practicing witchcraft and stuff compared to the Jews. So these people were looked down upon by the Jewish people, and Matthew tells that story very similarly to the way Jesus tells the Good Samaritan story. Do you remember the story there with the Good Samaritan? A Jewish guy is mugged, and he's left for dead on the side of the road, and several Jewish leaders, prominent people in Jewish culture, pass by. They are the ones that look like they should stop and help their own fellow Jew, and they don't. What happens is a Samaritan ends up coming by, somebody that the Jews hated racially. There was racial tension there. And the Samaritan's the hero of the story because he comes along and sees the Jew that he's supposed to hate and who's supposed to hate him. And he ends up picking the Jew up and taking him and caring for him and taking care of his wounds and paying for him to stay in a place to recover. So it's very interesting that who looks like they should be the enemy actually becomes the hero of the story. And while the Magi were Gentiles who were seeking God's signs, all of the Jewish people in the story don't do that, right? Herod, the religious leaders, they're not seeing the signs. They don't want to see the signs. The people who look like they should be close to God aren't. The people who look like they should be far from him are close to God here. So you could say it like this if you're taking notes. God can save those who seem farthest from him. That's the God that we serve. Matthew is making that point here. It's no accident that he starts the gospel account here by pointing out that the first people who search out the king of the universe are Gentiles. They're not Jews. Very interesting. And then he ends his gospel that way. Matthew 28, he talks about making disciples of all nations. So he bookends his entire gospel with helping us see that Gentiles are seeking. Those who are seeking after the truth here. God wants to save all people, especially those who seem farthest from him. He wishes that none would perish. He sent Jesus into the world to save the world, all of the world, who would believe in him. Not just one group, but everybody, every tribe, every language, every nation. But it is crucial, I think, in this story that they were searching, right? The wise men were searching. So you could say this, the gospel is for those who seek the truth. I mean, it's not just for everybody willy-nilly. It's for those who are searching for what's true. See, the wise men were watching for signs. They were willing to test the claims that they heard to see if it was true. I mean, that's the definition of having an open mind versus having a closed mind. And at every turn, they were pursuing the truth. I immediately think of a guy named Nabil Qureshi in this. Maybe you guys have heard his story before. If you haven't, he grew up a devout Muslim in the United States. And in an American context, his parents taught him all of the Islamic apologetics that they could so they would fortify him against the Christian culture here. Especially as he grew, they knew that he would be around a lot of Christians. And so they taught him all of the answers to the Christian problems that would be in the conversation of an apologetical discourse, which apologetics just means defending your faith, right? And so he would defend Islam against Christianity. And it's funny, though, because in college at ODU here in Old Dominion University here in Virginia, actually over in Norfolk, he met his good friend named David Wood. And he and David started having conversations because David had grown up a Christian. But he was asking a lot of hard questions as he went to college, a lot like my story, you know, where he was trying to figure out what he actually believed. And so as they talked to one another, they really sharpened one another. And I think David grew into his faith much deeper. And Nabil actually grew into his Islamic faith much deeper, or at least he dug in deeper. They went back and forth a lot. And to make a long story short, basically what ended up happening is Nabil started questioning what Muhammad himself had actually taught in the Quran. And he compared Muhammad versus Jesus and what Jesus actually taught and how he lived in the Bible. And he started comparing these two things, and he started seeing the inconsistencies in Islam without going too deep into it. So he started thinking through textual, historical, philosophical criticisms. And that started making him question what he believed. But then on top of that, he actually had a vision that he believed was supernatural that pointed him in the direction that he needed to go, is how he phrased it. Very much like the star with the wise men here. But then he also, on top of that, had three dreams. Very interesting. We saw some dreams here in our text as well. They were for Joseph. But God uses this a lot. And he said these supernatural dreams led him to not only question his Islamic faith, but then to put his faith in Jesus as he talked to David and David shared the gospel with him. So for him, it was a combination of all of these things in his life. All of these pieces of evidence that he had, the textual evidence, the historical evidence, the philosophical evidence, the comparing evidence of Muhammad and Jesus, the supernatural evidence that he believed that he had in his life, all of that persuaded him that he needed to begin to follow Jesus, and we have to be willing to test the claims that we say we believe as well. We have to be willing to see whether what we believe is plausible or not, whether it could be true. Is there any evidence? Is there historical, textual, philosophical evidence for us? We have to follow those things to their logical ends. Anybody should do that, whether it's in Christianity or whether it's in something else, atheism, whatever. The burden of proof is on you because nobody knows, right? If everybody knew the one thing, then we'd all believe the same thing, but we don't. And so we have a faith that is based in reality, based in historical evidence, based in truth. What do you have? If you're not a Christian, what do you have? And if you are a Christian and you don't have that foundation, I'd encourage you to start having that foundation. Figure out why you believe what you believe. But if you're not a Christian, I'd encourage you to press into that. It's apparent that the Magi had done that. Right? They had heard the claims, they'd heard the rumors going around. They dug into that, and they tried to figure out what the truth was. And if you're willing to do that and go that way and seek the truth, then the gospel is for you, whoever you are. There's no cultural or racial or ethnic or language or economic class barrier here in Christianity. None of that. There's only a willingness to search for the truth barrier, you see. So the gospel is for everybody who's open to it. That means that we, if we believed in that truth, if that's our foundation, if we've searched out the truth and found that it's something that we can put our hope and faith in, then it's up to us to start sharing that with others and to start engaging them on that truth. It's a massive claim. Man, if you were in the ballistic missile moment and you believed that it was happening, wouldn't you have been telling all your neighbors? I'm sure everybody walked outside and was like, can you believe what's happening? Spend this time with your loved ones. They want to make sure everybody knew. We have to do the same thing as Christians. And so we could say this, if you're taking notes, our mission is God's mission to reach the nations. That's our mission now. If we've believed this truth, if we believe the claims, we've tested them, we've put our faith in Jesus and in the Bible. That's one reason why here at Redemption Church, we emphasize church planting and missions. That's why that's important to us, because the gospel is for everyone in the world. It transcends cultural barriers, right? There are Christians all across the world right now in almost every language, every nation, every ethnicity. But man, there are still some unreached people groups in the world, people who have never heard and have no access to hearing like we do in the United States. There might be unreached people here in the United States, but they have access. We have the internet. They have freedom. They have neighbors around them. There are churches everywhere in the United States still. I don't know how long that'll last, but they're still here, right? There are Christians here. They have access, but there are people all across this world that don't even have access. They'll never hear unless somebody takes it to them intentionally. According to the group Finishing the Task, there are still unreached people groups that have no known full-time workers involved in evangelism and church planting. There are currently 149 unengaged and unreached people groups. Unengaged, unreached means nobody has gone to them. They will have no access unless it's taken to them. So according to some sources, there's still over 3,000 unreached people groups across the world, depending on how you define unreached there. But the gospel is for all of them. Whether it's 149, 3,000, doesn't really matter. The gospel is for everyone. And you might ask the hard question there, does that mean that if they don't hear the gospel, then they're going to go to hell? I've talked a little bit about this before, and I think it's really important that I start by saying this. We cannot pronounce eternal judgment on people. That is not up to us to do. That is not our responsibility. That is God's responsibility. He is God, and we are not, and we cannot say whether someone does or does not go to heaven or go to hell. when they die, because we're not God. That's arrogant to do. It's wrong to do. But we can clearly see the warning signs that Jesus gives all people in the Bible, can't we? We can hear the ballistic missile warning going off. It's clearly marked out here in the Bible for us, all of us. And it says that Jesus is the only way to God. I mean, that's what the Bible teaches. That's what Jesus teaches, which means that we take the mission to share the gospel and to make disciples of all nations very seriously. Because if we don't tell them, that they won't even be able to make the choice as to whether they believe or not. So the unpopular answer to the question is yes, when people die, they will die an eternal death if they don't believe in Jesus beforehand. And that's just what the Bible teaches us. But that means we need to feel the weight of that. We need to sit under that. Because now it's our responsibility to share when we believe. I mean, that's what the Bible teaches us. We are to go and make disciples of all nations. Jesus said that it's better for us to do that than for him to remain here and do it. Can you believe that? That's our responsibility now. It's one of the main reasons why God's left us here on earth. And I've heard Derwin Gray talk about this all the time. He's like, listen, if God wanted us to be comfortable and he just wanted to save us and it was just about us and him, then he would have taken us to heaven when we believed. We would just be snatched up off this earth and wait until he comes back for his second advent. But that's not what God does with us. He brings us to the place where we believe, and then we start to worship him with our whole lives. Our life changes, and our mission changes in life. Our purpose in life changes. It's no longer about us at all. It's about him and reaching the world. Have you realized that your life's purpose now, if you follow Jesus, is to live on mission for him? Have you realized that if you claim to be a Christian, have you realized that your life's purpose now, your mission in life now, whether you recognize it or not, is to share the gospel with your neighbors and to share the gospel maybe even with people across the world that don't know Jesus? That's what God calls us to when we worship this king. And that may mean some of you going to the unreached people, the unengaged, unreached people groups of the world. Some of you sitting right here, I don't know. I would love that. I'm praying for that for our church. That some we will be able to send people to those unengaged, unreached people groups. Because the gospel is for everyone. And it's partly our responsibility that God gives us to share that with whoever will listen and whoever is seeking the truth. It means you have to really worship with a heart like the wise men have here. Seeking the truth, not with a half-hearted response to Jesus. It cannot be half-hearted, because honestly, there's no half-hearted response. It's either belief or it's rejection. Apathy is also a response, right? And that leads to the second point that we can deduce from our story today. We all worship something as our king. We all do that. No matter whether you're Christian or not, whether you're religious or not, you might be like, well, I don't worship anything. I'm not religious. That's not me. But listen, we all worship something, because what you worship is what you ascribe highest priority to in your life. That's all worship is. Worship is adoration and honor and devotion given to someone or something in your life. It's what we value most. So worship might be a religious term, but it's something that we all do. We all have something that we value the most in our life. When we do that, even if we don't like to use the word, it's worship. You can do that with your children. You can do that with your future. You can do that with your job performance, how you're perceived by others, with the amount of money that's in your bank account, with your reputation, with your comfort and your pleasure, something else in your life. And you can usually tell what you worship when you figure out what drives you. What is it that drives your life? What do you focus on? What do you daydream about when you're daydreaming? What hopes do you have for the future? What is it that occupies most of your time and your thoughts and your emotions? Those can be indicators of whatever it is you worship. Just think about what you adore. Like if we use the word adore, adoration, when you adore something, you just can't get your mind off of it, right? Like it's just so beautiful to you. You just love that thing. I get the visualization of batting your eyes at something, you know? You're just like, oh, that's so awesome. I love that thing. It's very much how my wife and our two girls, if I'm being honest, look at our son, Bo. Okay? Complete adoration. They love, he's so chubby and cute that they just want to squeeze him to death, right? It's slightly disturbing how much they adore him. Here, I'll show you a picture just so that you get an idea. He is adorable, right? I mean, he is pretty adorable. I would like to claim that that's probably because he looks like his daddy a little bit, all right? I don't know, man. Could be wrong there. But man, I love that. Yeah, I mean, he's adorable. Maybe an idolatry issue in our house, I'm not sure, but it's like the Despicable Me scene. Every time they see Bo, you know, they're just like, where Agnes, she sees the fluffy unicorn, she's like, it's so fluffy, I'm going to die, right? She just gets so, oh my gosh, I've got to have that. It's so, I want to touch, I want to love it, I want to squeeze it. That's adoration. You know, it's intense, it's consuming. You can't take your mind off of that thing. Whatever you adore, whatever you honor, whatever you devote yourself to, it changes the way that you see things. It colors in your perspective in everything else in your life. It changes how you live, how you think, how you make decisions, how you feel. It makes you single-minded. It resets all of your priorities in life. Man, that is worship. And if that's not King Jesus that makes you feel that way, I want to be gentle here. You're probably not a Christian. Like that's just probably the reality of it. If you don't feel that way about Jesus, if you don't have that longing, if you don't have that, oh, I just want to see him. If you don't have that in your life, you might not be a Christian, even if you've been a churchgoer most of your life. Many cultural Christians grow up in church. They've done this, and they don't even realize it. They've gotten just enough of the truth. They've gotten just enough of the gospel just to be inoculated to it. You know, they don't end up really worshiping Jesus with their whole life. They just call themselves Christians because it's convenient, and they go to church. They see going to church as a way to get to God and to please him with their lives rather than seeing that they're a part of the church that God has saved for his mission in the world, you see. They'll do things like expect pastors to do the work of the ministry. You know, I mean, I've heard J.D. Greer say this a lot. It's a tongue-in-cheek saying that he says that when he entered the pastorate, he left the ministry because now it's the job of the pastor to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. So cultural Christians will often see themselves as being in the church rather than being mobilized for them to be on mission and to serve the city that they're in and to go to the unreached people groups in the nations. So you can write it down this way. We can say that we're a Christian without worshiping Jesus as our King. We can say that all that we want, but if we don't worship Jesus as our King, then we're not a Christian. I mean, you'll notice that Herod saw himself as the King. That was his identity, you see. Because in a worldly sense, he was. I mean, that was his title. But then when he was confronted with somebody who might have been the true king that had a claim, a legitimate claim of authority over his life, man, it elicited a dramatic response for him, didn't it? The religious leaders did the same thing here, too. They were people who said that they were close to God. They said they were religious leaders. They said they were Pharisees. Because Pharisee, Sadducee, that was synonymous with good Jew. Good with God. They were close to God in everybody's eyes. But man, when put to it, they didn't really follow God at all. They followed themselves. They saw themselves as the king of their life. And Christians can be the exact same way. It's easy to say you're a Christian, but it's hard to live like one. Now, if you want to know what it looks like to live as a Christian, go back to our Fulfilled series that we did right before this, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus will tell you. Yeah, you could look back at that and see if you need that help to understand what it looks like to be a Christian, because it starts with recognizing your spiritual bankruptcy. That's how it starts. I won't go into the details there. Go back and listen to those, but I can tell you that it starts with the final point that I want to make today as your first step. Worship Jesus as your King. That's what we need to take away from this. That's how it starts. We have to worship Jesus as our King. It's the only appropriate response if we've truly encountered this newborn King. He's the only one with a rightful claim over your life. What's crazy is the wise men believed that without even seeing the whole picture. I mean, just think about the evidence that they had. They only had some prophecies from the Old Testament that they were trying to see if there was a fulfillment to, and they had a star, which may have been supernatural. But now we can see that picture clearly because we see Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. We worship not just the King who was born, but the King who was sent to the cross for us, right? We see that whole thing. And I know some of you guys might think that it doesn't sound as compelling as what the wise men were working with. It seems like they had some supernatural sign here. You know, if God showed me a supernatural sign, then I would believe like they did. But listen, the answer is he has. He has shown you these things. He has given this testimony that we have here in the Bible. We have even more than they had to believe. They only had the Old Testament. We have all of the accounts of the New Testament, like Matthew's gospel here, that show us how Jesus fulfilled all of the Old Testament prophecies. He points it out in black and white, that we can go and chase those things down and see, did this happen? Did this happen? Yeah, all these things line up here. And if you track out all the Old Testament prophecies that talk about the Messiah, there are 60 major prophecies that are clearly about the Messiah in the Old Testament. There's hundreds of other implications that we could make, but there's at least 60 major prophecies, like what Matthew quoted here in his text, that predict where the Messiah would be born, like in Bethlehem from Micah that we read, how he would be born of a virgin, that he would be of the lineage of David, that he would die a bloody death and be pierced for our transgressions, that he would be a suffering servant and yet be a king. And there's a whole bunch more, right? Jesus fulfills all 60 of those. That's what's crazy about this. The likelihood that anybody would fulfill perfectly, down to the last detail, just 48 of the prophecies is, get this, the statistics are astronomical. 1 in 10 to the 157th power. That's 10 with 157 zeros after it. That means there's no chance here. There's no chance that this would just happen. It's not a happenstance. It has to be hyper-intentional. I know that may not answer all your skepticism about the Bible if you're still on the fence. You need to go and chase down whether these prophecies are actually trustworthy or not. We do have things like the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have historically verifiable evidence. We have ancient manuscript evidence. I mean, you go chase all of that down. And if it's not convincing to you, man, do that. I would implore you to go find the answers on your own, because the claims are huge here. And if it's true, and if it really is trustworthy, and Jesus does fulfill these prophecies, they weren't written after the fact. They were written thousands of years, in some cases, before Jesus was even born. And we can verify that historically. Then, man, something's going on here, right? Something's going on that we need to respond to, because if we don't respond, then it's a response, you see. And what this is telling us here, what Matthew is showing us, is that it is wise to worship Jesus as our King. There is evidence. These claims are true. And that's how the wise men were here. They believed the prophecies. They were looking for the signs. So when that star rose, man, they followed it. And not only did they follow it, but they told others about it along the way. And not only did they tell others, but when they finally got to their king, they bowed down and they worshiped him. They humbled themselves. They sacrificed even their wealth, giving him gifts. Now, I'm sure they weren't perfect. I'm sure they didn't do everything exactly as God wanted. I mean, they were pagans. They were magicians, for crying out loud. These guys were in the occult. And yet they recognized something, and they gave a radical response to what they saw was true, giving their time, talent, and treasure. You know, I could get back to that somehow, right? So you could write this down as a point. True worship is giving your time, talent, and treasure. That's what true worship is. That's why we use that language here at Redemption Church. That's why we make a big deal out of it. You see all three of them here. If we look at the wise men, they used their talents of stargazing and all of their wits, their academics, their skills to read the situation, to pursue the truth, and to search out the king. But then they traveled probably over 1,000 miles, which could have taken them up to 5 months with a large caravan of people to complete at this time in human history. So they were willing to give a lot of time to this endeavor, because then they had to travel back. I mean, it doesn't say how long they stayed either, so who knows how long they stayed. So this was a month's endeavor, maybe probably a year or more. But then, of course, they gave their material wealth away in his honor, didn't they? And it wasn't out of duty that they did this. It was out of adoration. They looked at that baby, and, well, I guess it could have been the same response as my wife has to Beau. At least they had it spiritually, you see. They had that response spiritually. They just had to see him. They were so compelled that they wanted to be there. They wanted to give of their time, talent, and treasure. They couldn't help but worship him. They couldn't help but give gifts to the one who's the greatest gift that the world has ever known. Their hearts were so full. They were willing to empty themselves of everything because they were so full of God's presence and God's joy as they worshiped. They were willing to give their time, talent, and treasure. The problem is, we all have a little Herod sitting on the throne of our own heart. See, that's the problem. When it comes up against it and we see that we should be worshiping like they did, we know that we all have this little Herod sitting on our own heart's throne. We all think that we should be the king over our own lives. We all do this. This is the human condition. But setting your own desires on the throne of your heart always leads to death, destruction, frustration. I mean, for Herod, his idolatry leads to rejection of the true king. Yes, but his sin leads to the brutal murder of all the boys in and around Bethlehem that are under 2 years old. I mean, it leads to literal death and destruction for families. See, he was willing to go to great lengths to kill the king of his heart, to the point that he was willing to kill others to make sure that he didn't have to worship the king. That's what our sin does in our lives. Even if it never leads us to kill someone, though maybe it has, I don't know your story. Maybe you have had to go through that. Abortion is very prevalent still. I know the numbers are going down, but man, it's very prevalent in our culture today. Christians have to recognize that there has been complete grace. We worship the King because he has shown us complete grace in those moments. Even though our sin takes us to the depths of where we should go, it takes us down to the deepest, darkest holes that we could go into. We serve a King who has shown us so much grace that he came down into the world for us to be there with us in that ditch, in that downward spiral. See, sin always leads to death. You can write that down if you're taking notes. Our sin always leads to death. Whatever that looks like, spiritual death, physical death in the end, it leads to that. And that's actually the answer to the problem of evil that most people who aren't Christians will point to as a reason not to believe in God. Actually, but see, they'll ask questions like, why did God allow Herod to kill these children? This is brutal. It's wicked. It's evil. Why would God allow this evil act if he really is good? Couldn't he step in and stop all of the evil in the world? Stop our evil if we're really evil, right? We'll ask all these questions, but see, God gives us a choice as to whether or not we are going to accept or reject him. And with that choice comes personal responsibility in our lives. Herod was responsible for his reaction to Jesus as the true king. See, he thought he was the king. That was his response, and it led to this evil, and it led to this tragedy, and it led to death and destruction. And that's what our sin does every time. But see, there's only one true king that we should be worshiping, and it's not us. It's not you or me. Jesus was born not just king of the Jews, but king of the universe. And he lived a perfect life for you and for me in our place. He lived the life that we should live, but we don't. And he dealt with our sin by living that sinless life on our behalf, you see. But then he didn't stop there. He died in our place. The death that we deserve. See, he took on that punishment for our rebellion. We have tried to usurp the throne. We've tried to take the king off of his throne. That's treason. And that kind of treason deserves death when we try to be the king over our own life, when there is a real, true king that deserves our worship. See, the beauty of the gospel is that the tragedy of the cross is the only thing that can deal with the tragedy of human sin. It's the only thing. So you can write it down this way. Our sin leads to death, but Jesus' death leads to life for us. His death leads to our life. That is the beauty of the gospel that we see here. Our king bore a crown of thorns for us. Our king had a sign posted over him in mockery that said, King of the Jews. Our king died so that we could live. What other king would do that for his people? What other king? Only the God of the universe, who really is good. He really is benevolent. He really is for us. But see, the beauty of the gospel doesn't even stop there. Listen, he lived the perfect life. He died the death for us, but then he rose from the dead to destroy death so that one day he'll return as a victorious king for his second advent. See, at Christmas, we celebrate the first advent, right? But we're also looking forward to the second advent when he comes as this victorious king, and he's going to raise us from the dead with him. Man, that is the beauty of Christmas right there. Because now when we believe in this king that we see laying in a manger, yeah, we're going to follow him imperfectly. Yeah, we'll still rebel at times. We're not going to be perfect in our life, but God isn't interested in our perfection. He's interested in our worship. We will worship him if we really see him for who he is. We see him as the king who was born into the world and who died for us His death covered all our sin, past, present, and future. He's going to bring us into perfection in his own time. He's going to complete that good work that he started in us. Right now, our wise response is to simply worship him. Yeah, that's what we're here to do. And that worship will produce fruit, and we will begin to live a certain way. But we got to get the priorities right. And Christmas calls us to go back and to reevaluate our priorities. Have we been relying on what we can do as Christians? Have we been relying on our religion? That's still setting yourself on the throne of your own heart. You realize that, right? Because you can control that, you see. But our God is not to be controlled. Our God has shown so much grace, so much love. He's done it all for you. He doesn't expect us to be perfect. He expects us to worship. So worship today. And this is not a message that elicits a lukewarm response, is it? When somebody starts hearing this kind of truth, this is what Christianity, this is what the Bible, this is what Jesus taught, they're going to have one of two reactions. It's either going to be to reject Jesus as the king, or it's going to be to bow. It's going to be to humble yourself. It's going to be to recognize his authority, to worship him, because you really see him for who he is. And if you're a Christian here today, you might need to see where you could be holding something back from Jesus as your king. You might need to repent and turn back to him and say, God, I recognize that I'm not giving up some things. I've maybe been living in a certain way that's not consistent with this grace that you've shown me. I've not been really worshiping you with my whole heart. Don't hold on to those things. That's foolishness. Don't hold on to any of that. Be wise. Worship Jesus totally. Give him your whole heart, your whole mind, your very life. And see that your new purpose now as a Christian is to worship him and share that worship with the nations. And if you're not a Christian here, man, I hope you'll take the time to dig into some of these things that we've discussed. Man, let a Christian walk you through this. Somebody that you trust, ask them why they believe what they believe. Ask them for the evidence. Tell them what you're hung up on, what's holding you back, and then talk that out with them. That's so important that you do, because I'm praying for you that you will do the wise thing and you will worship Jesus as your king. Let me pray for you. God, man, what a hard message in some ways. Matthew's just smacking us right in the face here in the Christmas season to see the truth that Jesus is the king that deserves our worship. God, I pray for all of us here that we would bow to you in our heart, that we would really see Jesus for who he is, and that if we are just hung up on some of these things, we don't believe that this is rooted in truth. We don't believe the Bible is verifiable. We don't believe that it's trustworthy. It was written by a bunch of men. It was written by all these things, you know, thousands of years ago. It's not trustworthy. God, I pray that if somebody is here thinking that or listening to this online, that they would dig in, that they would reach out to someone they trust, try to figure this thing out, because the claims are too huge. God, help us today. And if we're Christians here, God, I pray that we would leave here worshiping you as our king with our whole heart, living on mission for you, because the gospel that we have believed is for everyone. Thank you, God, that you use the example of these spiritual occultists, the magicians, to show us that no matter who you are, what background you come from, you can still bow your knees to the king of the universe and move forward in a new way in your life. Oh, God, I pray that if there's someone here who is struggling with that, that they would believe today. And God, I pray that if they believe, that you would push them to be baptized next week so that they can take their first step of obedience in following you as a disciple of Jesus, as a follower of Jesus' teachings. Please, God, push them to that. And we're thankful that you've already pushed some to that and that we're going to have baptisms next week. It's going to be awesome. Thank you, God, that you're doing that here at Redemption Church. That's why we came, to see you change people. God, that's just all you. It's for your glory. You are the king worthy of worship. And we know that wherever the gospel is preached truly, you will be present and you will work in people's lives, and they will be called to one of two responses, to reject or to believe and worship. So I pray, God, that if people are hearing this, they would believe. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks for listening to the message with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for meeting together with other believers in a local church context. And so we hope that you'll get plugged into a local church wherever you are. And if you're here in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us at Redemption Church. For more content and resources, just check out our website at redemptionroanoke.com. Thanks again for listening.